Okay. Everybody can hear me? Good. So I'm Yannis Tevebalducci. I'm a PM for the Exchange Mobility team. I joined Microsoft about 10 years ago into this small team called ActiveSync. And at the time, they were working on this little thing called AirSync, which turned out to be a little bigger than people realized then. And 10 years later, I'm talking about Exchange ActiveSync as a protocol. So let me quickly say what I'm going to be talking about. I have to say a quick word on IP. Actually, also, if you have any questions throughout, just feel free to jump in, because I don't really know what, you know, whether you're building clients, servers, gateways, etc. So if you hear something and want a clarification, jump right in. So I need to say something about IP licensing. Brief history of the protocol, just so you get an idea of like where it's coming from and why certain things end up, you know, looking the way they do. Because people say history, you hear versioning. I have to say a few words on that. And then finally, the big gist of it is going to be the actual protocol, though unfortunately in 45 minutes, I don't think everybody here will be able to just go home and code it. That would take more like 3 days. Hopefully, with 45 minutes, you'll be able to at least understand how the structure of the documentation works and know where the answers are within that documentation. At least that's my goal. So IP licensing of Exchange ActiveSync. So all the documentation is found online. You can go to MSDN, this link, and everything is there, which means that if you go back to your basement, your garage, whatever, and you decide to code and play with it, it's great. The second you want to potentially make it more than just playing in your garage, you're going to want to license it. You're not licensing the protocol. You're licensing the IP behind the protocol. Now, I'm not a lawyer. No lawyer saw this slide, or else it would be in 10-point font. But I do have that address at the bottom and an email. So if you're actually looking for to doing real business with Exchange ActiveSync, shoot the email before they shoot an email back to you. That would be my recommendation. So the protocol, where it came from. So as I mentioned earlier, it was just the idea was that, you know, back 10 years ago, 12 years ago, you had these pocket PC devices. And it was clear that smartphones were coming online. And you could basically connect them to Outlook and get your calendar, contact, and email. And it was great, except that, you know, if you want to send an email and you weren't next to your computer, it would just queue up, and then you'd have to go home and connect it. And we know how much joy that brings to people and who've used that software. And we also realized that, yeah, you could do it over Wi-Fi, but then setting it up was a problem. So essentially the problem was, how do we bring Outlook to a mobile device, and how we do it in a way that you can access from everywhere? Everywhere meant internet. It meant proxies, firewalls, and so on and so forth. The answer was, why don't we do it over HTTP, right? Why don't we do it using standard SSL and so on and so forth? So that's where it started. So it started not as a server product initially, though it was going to be a server product, but really more like from the client perspective. We need to get to that information, and we're going to build some service, server, et cetera, to get to it. So we released it first in what was called Mobile Information Server, which probably not many people know about. Exchange, though, realized that, you know, this was actually something important. And so Exchange took it over in Exchange 2003, so it shipped with Exchange. During that time, people realized that it was much bigger than just pocket PC and smartphones, that other phone manufacturers would want it. They approached us, actually, and ultimately the licensing program that is in place started there. In Exchange 2007, more functionality got added, right, because people want more checkboxes, they want more things, whether it's S/MIME to, you know, retrieving certificates, to getting pictures in contact, to searching the gal, searching my email, et cetera, HTML, so on and so forth. All that information is probably published in the various Exchange versions online, or you can get, you know, some useful single link where customers actually maintain that information. Who says versions of Exchange probably says versions of the protocol. So, busy slide, but the gist of it is to understand that servers generally support more than one version of the protocol. Versions are on the left. 1.0 was the original client. As you can see, it's getting deprecated. It's essentially a sliding window, so as we get more servers out, we probably, you know, I can't guarantee that we'll come up with new versions to add new functionality, but if we do, we'll probably deprecate some old ones and so on. The documentation is specifically built for 14.1, which is the latest. Notice that these are SPs, and the reason I bring SPs is that most deployments of Exchange actually are the latest bits, right? Very few people, you know, ship 2003 and stay on RTM for 10 years. And so if you really notice, the fulcrum points are really the latest of a given SP. And so if you're a client maker and you decide what you want to support, essentially, you could say, I'm going to support them all. You know, great for you. Or if you want to cut some corners, you could say, well, what about supporting sort of the latest ones, right? And of course, part of the what you're going to support also depends on what functionality you want. So 2.5 has less functionality than 12.1, less than 14.1, and so on. One way to figure out what's supported is, I'm going to call it out, is the options request as a client. If, however, you want to figure out what a client supports, you can probably boot up some beta version of Exchange and figure it out using the logs, the client logging, or even double-click on a device on the properties page and so on. Now, as to the documentation, like I mentioned, it's really built 14.1 and moving backwards to 12.1. So as to the technologies that are used, I mentioned HTTP and SSL, so very standard technologies. One of the reasons that really made Exchange Active Sync work is that most of the deployments, I mean, it's Exchange, but most of the deployments are very standard. So if you're a client manufacturer or if you are a gateway product in the middle, it's HTTPS mostly. It's basic auth. Some people have managed to push certificate auth, but that is, so if you build a client and you want to hit the most secure of your customers, you have to basically provide certificate auth. The challenge there is, how do you get certificates on the device and so on? Now, if you are working for the company that has that installed, they have a whole process around it. So they have a way to get the certificates on the devices and so on, and, so, and manage the certificates and so on and so forth. The other thing is, most of the traffic is actually going from the server to the client. So somewhere along the line, somebody said, wait, why don't we just, you know, compress this? I mean, it's a mobile protocol after all. And instead of using some, you know, technology of ours, like, you know, to Exchange Active Sync only, we just said, well, no, let's use IIS, right? So when I talk basic auth, IIS does it for us. When I talk GZIP here, IIS, you know, the server does it for us. So it's all standard technology. The reason to only do it one way is, again, most of the information actually flows from the server to the device. Also, the device probably doesn't want to get into the business of compressing things. And if you use if a server is set up for compression, you'll get the standard HTTP header to tell you what kind of compression it is, and so on. Now, the content of EAS is essentially XML, but XML is just a way to schematize data. So an example would be, if I have a subject of an email, I could get a tag, and it could be called subject of email, and then the subject of the email would go within, and then at the end, I would just close a tag saying end of subject of email. No problem with XML. The issue is, if you have developers that have really long, you know, XML strings in there to make it nice and verbose, then the body of it grows, right? And so the first version did not have any compression at all. So somebody said, wait, why don't we use tags that are fixed in length? And so we looked and we said, well, WBXML, which stands for white byte XML, seems to fit the bill. And what it is it's just a way to use a tag and compress it down to a couple of bytes. So if you actually look at it, it's very hard to read. It's not really human readable unless you have the MSAS WBXML document, which has essentially just a bunch of tables saying what the tags map to in terms of XML. So if you build XML, you can then go through a builder parser that compresses it, and if you get this XML, you can go to the parser and build the XML out of it, essentially. So another thing we saw was that HTTP headers, most devices will send headers clear text. In other words, as a human, you can read, this is a sync command, this is a policy key, this is what it's trying to do from the headers. Some devices, however, thought, well, why don't we save some bytes? And what they did is essentially they took all that information that's supposed to go into the headers, serialized it, and put it into one base64 block. So if you want to get a table of how to deserialize that, if you're in the server products or if you're doing gateway, that's all in the ASHTTP documentation. The other reason to actually do this is that some gateways, shall rename unnamed, alter HTTP headers or do things. And unfortunately, if they seem to think they know what they're doing, they might take things out from the that were sent up by the client to the server, and so the server might respond in ways that the client didn't expect. So by doing this base64 encoding of the strings and the content, it sort of tells gateways, you know, stop messing around with what we're sending, essentially. So dual purpose there. By the way, yes?
Is that question? The shrinking of headers version specific?
So it started, I believe, yes. So the question was whether the compression of the headers or the base64 encoding of the headers, whether it was version specific. So yes, and I believe it started in 12 or 12.1 and moved all the way to, so we keep going at it.
And it's the client's responsibility?
Yes.
The client, okay.
So the server is like, even if you use 14.1, you don't have to compress headers, but you can as a client.
Okay.
So some clients decide to do it, some clients decide not to do it. We have not seen a large number of gateways mess up with HTTP headers. So, you know, in most cases it works, but, you know, so when I worked on the client side of things, we saw a couple and we just didn't know how widespread the problem was, and we just said, yeah, let's just fix it and never have to deal with this.
Thanks.
So I said HTTP, and we're mostly fully HTTP compliant. If you build a client stack, however, there's a few things that you need to be able to handle. Few things in terms of responses that are non-standard HTTP responses. One of them is the 451, which is essentially a redirect. And the way to think about this is, let's say you have a client that's talking to mail.contoso.com and everything is working great. One day, Contoso decides to have expand regionally and decides to have a, you know, America continent server deployment and a European server deployment content, you know, and so they want to split the traffic. When that happens, they might move mailboxes around and so on. And so what the server does is it'll try to tell the client, no, the better server for you to like keep getting the content from this mailbox is this other server. And if you were already synchronizing and doing everything normally, what it means as a client is at some point you'll just get 451, actually it went over there, right? And as long as it's a client, you basically interpret the x-ms location header, you can just continue syncing to that and everything will be fine. So some client developers seem to not have read that part of the spec, so I'm just calling it out specifically. The other one that was non-generic is 449. It's actually moved to a status inside the XML. 449 really is an interrupt or a roadblock. What it is if a client comes to the server and says, hey, I want to get new emails, the server has the right to say, not until you actually come and provision yourself. Provisioning is the concept of getting policies. It's also the concept of being remotely wiped and so on, right? And so it's look at it as an interrupt. Now, in the new EAS 14 and 14.1 protocol, we actually moved all that, the 449, into the status inside the XML, so you won't see that 449 again. But if you're building a client stack that supports other protocols, please take a look at that and make sure that you support it. If you don't, the market will basically, you know, the bloggers will get you, basically. Like, that's what it comes down to. In this case, basically, it means the client will get blocked, right? It'll get this 449. There's a whole lot of clients. There are a number of subpar clients out there that see this 449 and just stop. And, of course, the user of that client goes, why isn't it working, right? And I go, well, talk to the developer that built that client. or buy a new one, which is not a great response. The other one is 503. 503 is a very standard error in terms of HTTP, but the reason I'm calling it out is if you're going to build a client, please don't be the annoying coworker that just sticks around next to your cube asking for the same information over and over again. If you say, I'm busy, right? Go back to your cube, have a drink, and come back a little later, right? So as a client, if you're asking for new email and the server says, no, I'm busy, you may not want to ask for new email immediately afterwards, right? It's good for the client, it's good for the server. What I mean by that is we had some clients that really liked their email. They wanted to get it now, and they were asking for it 200 times a minute. Now, that's a very warm pocket because most clients are on a battery, right? So that's just not good for the client. It's not good for the server. The server can classify you as a bad client and throw you, you know, aside and so on. So, you know, smart thing is ask for it 2-3 times, wait 30 seconds, ask for it 2-3 times. If it doesn't work, keep another minute, right? Just back off smartly. Yeah, I mean, so most of those calls are generally very tiny, but yes, you're right. I mean, it's, you know, it's hundreds of them. One thing we did do in the server, and we try to do more of this, is to actually respond with when we think we're going to be free. So we have this retry after. So it's generally a number of seconds. It's a standard thing, but if you implement the HTTP stack, you know, listening to this would be great because most of the time we say, you know, come back 30 seconds later and you'll get what, you know, we think you. Of course, we can't predict what happens, right? If somebody trips over the power cord in like 20 seconds, we might not be able to get it. But if everything goes as you know, as we think it will in the next 27 seconds or whatever it says, you'll get it, right? So anyways, just be mindful of that. So now, if you're building a client, how do you connect to the server? The second part of this is you can say, okay, let me get the user to provide the server address. So I don't want a show of hands, but you know, most users, if you ask them what their corporate server email address is, you'll get this blank stare like, huh? You mean I don't open Outlook, right? And it's normal, right? I mean, some people know it, of course. I work in this, so I know it. But if you don't know it, it's sort of a. Now, you could go on an intranet website. You can send an email. You can call the admin, et cetera, and figure it out. But it's, you know, less than helpful. So you probably heard more auto-discover before, hopefully, throughout the day. EAS has auto-discover implemented for the mobile sync provider. So the EAS CMD document has how to do it. If you need more information, you can go look at the EWS specs as well and so on, because it's all the same way of doing auto-discover. The concept of auto-discover is you take an email address, john@contoso.com, and you make some calls to autodiscover.contoso.com, and based on how you get redirected, you hopefully will end up to the right mail.whatever.contoso.com, which will actually be able to service, you know, the sync requests. This part of it is not WBXML, so it's straight up XML and SOAP. And that's all I'm going to say on autodiscover. For authentication, so again, it's basic or cert auth. The virtual directory of Exchange Active Sync is always standard. So if you have a bunch of developers and you want to run in parallel, you can have some of them work on auto-discover while others do sort of the sync part of the things by just asking the username, right, so you can parallelize that. And you know the virtual directory is always that, so you can just run with it. One of the HTTP calls that we use is options. So most everything is post to the server, but options is the concept of asking the server, what do you support? We highly recommend that it be the first call that you make to the endpoint that you're trying to hit. And the reason is you saw the big chart of versions, and you probably as a client want to know, which version should I talk? Now, you can come up with a heuristic and say, I'm going to use the latest one I know. And if the server is confused, I'm going to use the one below that and the one below that and so on and so forth. Or B, you can send options and parse the text back, and it'll say, you know, you'll get a string that says 202125, et cetera, et cetera. If you see the one, you know, the latest one you've got, use that and, you know, start doing the sync and all the other things that to get the information. Now, before I start talking about how to get the information, I talked earlier about the 449, essentially that interrupt. And it was all based on this provision command. So WBXML, POST, HTTP, the provision command is a command used to retrieve policies from the server. It's also the command used to retrieve the wipe flag from the server. It's also the command used to actually acknowledge the wipe or acknowledge the provisioning of the device. So you could send it up front as a client, or B, you could go, no, let me try to sync first. So I'll go try to get email. Most likely, corporate servers are going to sort of put that interrupt in there and say status 140-something in the newest protocols, or they'll 449, which means the client has to come do provisioning. Now, HTTP is based on a client request server response. So the problem with provisioning is the server needs to know whether the client did receive this or not. And that's why they're always sent as pairs. So the first client request goes something like this. I am, and we have this device information block, which is new in 14.1. That's where you describe what model device you are, where you connected to T-Mobile, phone number, all these things. In Exchange Active Sync, in Exchange, all those that information shows up in ECP pages or to admins as well. Doesn't need to be provided. The model does need to be provided. And then the server responds, okay, I know who you are, and here are the policies you need to apply. You know, PIN needs to be 4 in length, you need to encrypt, you know, you need to wipe if you enter the PIN wrong 15 times, yada, yada, all the list. The next call is actually from the client to the server again, because it's HTTP, and the client has to say, I acknowledge the receipt of these policies, and I've applied them, right? And then the server is going to respond finally with what we call a policy key. The policy key is a string, and it should be used within the headers of every other request after this provisioning. The idea is that by using that key, the client is saying, I am at that state. So when you told me to enforce the PIN 4 in length, if that's the policy, this policy key is saying, okay, that's what I'm doing, right? At some point, the admin can say, okay, no, I actually meant 8 in length, right? Let's make it really unusable. And the policy, essentially, the client will get another interrupt for provisioning, and you'll get the new, you know, the client, you'll get the new policy, and you have to do something else. Now, so don't assume that provisioning, you do it once and you forget. It can happen any time based on a server request. Provision is also the way that wipe is sent to clients. So if an admin says, you know, I'm wiping this device, there's a flag, essentially. We interrupt the sync 449 or 140 errors. The client comes and says, provision me, and then in the response it says, actually wipe, you know, please wipe. The client acknowledges that that it has received that order, and then it formats C, whatever you do underneath, right? That's pretty much all I was going to say there. So, to the gathering of content, everything starts with folder sync. So before you actually know what the inbox is, very much like EWS, you need to sort of get an idea of what the folder hierarchy is, right? You know, essentially, you want to name which one the inbox is, which one sent item is, calendar, contacts, etc., right? So folder sync, as the name implies, synchronizes folders. Now, when it was designed, we thought, well, clients don't want to change the folder hierarchy. And that's mostly true. Except some ended up saying, oh, I really want to add folders and change folders and so on and so forth. So it's not a symmetric sync. What I mean by that is, in the HTTP, the client sends, if it does folder sync, it's saying, really, give me changes from the server. If it wants to make changes, we have other commands like folder create, folder update, and folder delete for that. The idea here, too, is we have a concept of a sync key. And the idea of a sync key is a token. The token is essentially saying from the server to the client, sorry, from the client to the server, this is my current state. So the first time around, the client has absolutely nothing. So it has no sync key. The agreement done for the ES protocols, if you know nothing, it's zero. So you send, when the client sends up a sync key of zero, the server is essentially going to return the entire folder hierarchy. And the way it looks is you're going to get a bunch of ads for each folder, right? It's a big list. And each folder has a name, an ID for itself, the parent ID, just in case you want to build the parent hierarchy, and the type of folder. So is it the standard inbox? Is it an email folder? Is it a calendar folder? Is it the standard calendar, et cetera? From then on, the client is supposed to save the folder sync key, and the next time around, reissue the last one it got. If it ever gets out of whack or returns an error from the server, it can always go back to zero. But zero is essentially telling the client, you know, resynchronize all your folder hierarchy and potentially all your content underneath, right? So you want to avoid that. So that's folder sync. So once you have the folder IDs, or you have the IDs of the folders you want to synchronize, you're going to want to issue a sync command. That's the bread and butter of EAS. The same concept of a sync key is used in sync, except it's used for each collection. Collections are folders. So if you sync the inbox, calendar, and contacts, you can now do it all in one HTTP request, and each one has its own sync key. And the reason is, behind it is, if you have changes in inbox but not in contacts, then the sync key of contacts probably doesn't change, and the inbox does, right? And again, it's to know what status, what the device last received. And the reason for it is it's HTTP, and people can drive into tunnels, sockets can drop, etc. So if this device, let's say, does a sync with SyncKey 7, and the server receives that, processes it, sends everything back, if the device drove into a tunnel, it didn't get the new content in SyncKey 8, right? Don't assume, by the way, that it's progressive like that. But so the next time around, the device will keep syncing with 7 because that's the last one it got, right? The server is smart enough to realize, okay, I know what happened. I'll deal with 7, right? And then it'll keep moving that way. But anyways, that's the idea of the sync key. If it ever goes out of whack, and the reason it would potentially is if you do a backup restore, right, from a very old state, you might have a really old sync key. You'll get back an error from the server. You can always go back to 0. Now, when you go back to 0 as a client, you have to be smart or careful, I would say, because you don't want to duplicate data, so you may have to like delete the local stores, maybe recreate another partnership, depending on how you do databases and so on. Just things to be mindful of. So sync is actually quite symmetric in that adds, changes, and deletes can come from the client to the server or the server to the client. The one difference is we have this concept of soft deletes coming from the server to the client. It's essentially a delete. But in EAS, filtering is done by the server. So the client is really dumb when it comes to knowing whether this email is 10 years old or got back 3 days ago. The server is the one that tells the client, you know, you told me you wanted to filter 3 days only. You should throw away these old ones, right? And the way we do that is we send soft deletes, which are essentially deletes. It doesn't mean that it got so it's basically a way to recognize whether the user deleted it versus it fell out of filter. And some devices make use of that and do different things. So the other rule of thumb is when the client changes an item, like a contact, it needs to send up all the fields of that contact. Otherwise, the agreement is if you don't send something, we'll delete it. And that's true on both sides. So the absence of a field essentially deletes it. Now, there is something else, which is called property ghosting. And the idea was, if you're a phone and contacts, you know, you really don't care about, I don't know what some different fields are, but you have a home address, work address, you have an other address, and so on and so forth. If you just care about 5 properties, on SyncKey 0, as a client, you can say, these are the properties I support. And by doing that, you're essentially telling the server, oh, you'll be throwing away everything else. Now, the server is a little dumb, I'll say that, in that it returns all the properties all the time. So even if the client said that it didn't care about work phone number, for example, the server will still return the work phone number to the client. But the client can safely throw it away, and if it doesn't reissue it, we won't go override it. That concept is called property-level ghosting. And again, ASCMD has that idea and how it's carried through on the different data types. So that works great for calendar, contacts, and so on. Email is slightly different, because we actually thought in EAS we're not going to give the ability to change subjects or bodies and things like that. So email, like, there's very few things you can change. Read flags, categories, and follow-up flags. So that's pretty straightforward. And finally, bodies. So contacts have bodies. Calendar have bodies, right? So notes, essentially the notes field. Bodies are change track, which means that if the client has not changed something, it doesn't need to send it back up. The reason for that was bodies are generally much bigger in size, so we special case that, and we actually track on the server and client. So that was the basic of sync command. Now, so you're thinking to yourselves, that's great, but how do I stay up to date, right? That was the big deal with, like, push email and, like, oh, it's up to date, instead of syncing every 5 minutes. Because if you do the other way, you can essentially sync, and the server is going to say, no changes, no changes, no changes, no changes. And then we thought of this better way of doing things, which is called hanging sync. Hanging sync is the idea of parking a sync or an HTTP request to the server in this fashion. You're essentially telling the server, if you have changes, give them to me now, because I care for them. But if you don't, I'm willing to wait up to this amount of time. That amount of time is passed as the heartbeat interval, and it's up to an hour. So essentially, the server will wait for that amount of time, and then it'll return. Some content is returned immediately. So a new email, for example, will break sync immediately. A change in read flag does not. So we opportunistically bundle it at the end and send it with whatever changes are there. The one thing to be mindful of is if you build a client, just because you say 1 hour doesn't mean that all the socket, you know, all the gateways, firewalls, proxies, and so on and so forth in between you and the server, you know, are going to understand that you want that socket to stay open for an hour. So the way it should be built is to basically try to figure out, you know, what the longest amount of time is that you can stay open while still getting back a response from the server. And I'll walk you through that for a second. So on the left, we have a trusty smartphone. Time is running down in this axis here, right under the server. So we issue a hanging sync. Essentially, we're saying to the server, give me content, and if you have nothing, park it. The server, after a given amount of time, says, hey, I got nothing for you. Now, that, and then the client has to essentially keep doing it, right, over and over in a loop. Now, the HTTP 200, I mentioned earlier that everything is WBXML. When it comes to empty, no changes, that's a very succinct response. It's just 200, nobody, nothing. And it's essentially interpreted by the client as, okay, I get it. You have no changes for me. I'll reissue the sync. By the way, the hanging sync as well, if sync has all sorts of options and so on, it is possible to get rid of a lot of that stuff, if not all, and just send the sync request, which the server interprets as, you want to sync the same folders as last time with the same settings as last time. So when you look at, you know, how many bytes actually go over the wire for what's called the constant hanging sync and the response, it's really, really, really small. But yes, the radio does have to go up, which means that you go to full milliamps and so on and so forth on the radio. So what I meant earlier is the way you essentially can build an algorithm to figure out what that length of time is by looking for that HTTP 200. So if you say an hour and you don't hear back from the server, that means something bad happened. You can assume something in the middle bad happened, which means that the hour is probably too long. So you can go 30 minutes. And if in 30 minutes you don't get back the HTTP 200, then you go to 20 and so on and so forth. I actually suggest doing it more like TCP/IP and going, you know, 10 minutes. Yes, I'm safe. Increasing that to 20 maybe. Yes, I'm safe. Going to 30, figure out that 30 doesn't work, and then optimize between 20 and 30 until you figure out what it is. You could, I guess, assume that the network that your phone is on is always the same, or you could essentially have an ongoing algorithm looking for changes, right? Because if you connect to a new, you know, the T-Mobile network in this city might not be the T-Mobile's been, you know, in that city, and so on and so forth, right? So anyways, when there is a change, very simple, you issue the hanging sync, change is detected by the server. This can also be, let's say, a remote wipe. immediately we return the change, and then the loop continues, right? So this is hanging sync. Some clients issue what we used to call ping, and I used to jokingly refer to as ping pong. So ping is essentially, unlike sync, it says, I'm interested in changes in these folders. And then the server goes, OK. So it's the same idea, except the response to ping is either a 200 or the ID of the folder where the change was, which means that when you do have a change, it's not that streamlined. The client gets essentially a response to the ping, and then it has to say, oh, OK, I have to sync that folder. It syncs that folder, gets the content, and then it reissues the ping. So it's just more back and forth. It's the old way of doing it. That's why I'm not really, you know, calling it out here. But if you're building a, you know, gateway or something, you do need to support that idea of ping versus hanging sync. So that was that. So I mentioned, yes, question in the back.
What if server has some data, but the client is shut down at that particular time? What happens then when the client starts up again? Is it the server's responsibility to notify, or the client request for something like fast transfer?
So because it's HTTP, it's always client's responsibility to come and get there's no channel, right? If the client went asleep, the socket died, the server may not know, or if it's smart and it realizes it can actually do some resource cleaning up. But ultimately, if the client went to sleep, hit a tunnel, went in the airplane, whatever, the client is the one who has to, upon change of state, have to come back and get the data.
How does it get the data? Does it still send the... Because client doesn't know there's a new data. Does it still send a hanging sync, or does it send a fast transfer request kind of thing?
So by fast transfer request, you mean just a regular sync? So see,
yeah, regular
sync. The beauty with hanging sync is that it's essentially a sync.
Oh,
the way you get data from sync, like saying if you sync inbox, there's really no difference between hanging sync of inbox and sync of inbox except for one tag, which is basically telling the server, if there is nothing, park it. So in your scenario, if there was a new email or something, just by issuing hanging sync, you'll be up to date. Because if there was something, we don't lose track of that, right? Because we have the sync key of your last changes that you've applied, we can go and essentially monitor what has changed since that sync key. So it guarantees the client is always up to date, but it does mean that the client has to be smart. So other examples are, on some networks, for example, if you get a phone call, you can't be on data and voice, right? On some, you can. If you can't do that, then it means the client has to be smart, and once the phone call ends, their EAS stack has to wake up and go back to doing that, right? So that, I mean, yes, the client has to be, you know, the state on the client has to be maintained. So, yes. Okay. So earlier I mentioned emails, calendar, contacts, so on. EAS is not built for what some people refer to as blob sync. We don't have the concept of like anything goes. We have a concept of what an email is, and we schematize that very well. We have a concept of what a calendar item is, and we schematize that, and a contact, and tasks, and notes. So each one of these is actually documented in their own schema documentation. The interesting one is email, and the reason I say that is because of meeting requests, email is also a little complex in that a meeting request actually has a calendar item within it, so it makes it a little more challenging. So the email one is interesting. I also wanted to call out, in email, we did a lot of work in the latest versions to provide two key things. One is the concept of conversations. So conversations are threads, email threads. You know, you email with somebody. The question is, can you do lunch Friday? No, Friday doesn't work for me. How about Sunday, you know, next Monday? Monday's great, right? There goes four emails, and all those emails generally have all the previous responses that were there. So if you see them on a normal client, that's what you'll see. In the example here, it's not a big problem because, you know, they're all one sentences. But how many times have we seen somebody go with like four or five paragraphs, what do you guys think? And then the explosion comes in, right? Like, no, change this, this and that, whatever. And all those little one sentences that are added, each time you essentially get the full body. So that all that those paragraphs that were there before, you get them each time. So now with conversations, we have this concept of body parts, diffs, parts, deltas, whatever you want to call them. And the idea is that there's a way now to synchronize only the last comment added to that email. So if you think of an email as having many, many parts and sub-emails within it, in EAS, you can actually request just the difference. Now, as a client, it means you do need to build, you do need to know how to build the body back. But if you guys have looked at Outlook Web Access or Office 2010, you'll see how conversations are part of a lot of UI. OWA does a great job at being able to jump between the parts, and now EAS gives that ability to clients as well. So there's two sides to it. One is increased readability, and the other side is better bandwidth. Because when somebody responds with one sentence, you're not re-downloading everything, which means that as a client, you can say, I actually want to download 50K for each email. But if you do body parts, it means most of the time, you can look at your own mailboxes to know how much, you know, how big emails are. Most of the time, you'll be getting a couple sentences. So even though you said, give me 50K, you're getting just these little transfers, and which is really great for mobile protocol. The other one is rights management. Rights management is the concept of sending an email to somebody and saying, you're not allowed to print it, you're not allowed to forward it. And it's encrypted, right? In ActiveSync, we actually supported rights management, but we supported it in a way that was very heavy for clients. They needed to know, essentially they needed to do Exchange ActiveSync, and then they needed to go figure out with the rights management team how to do rights management, right? So we gave the content from the server, but we did nothing. With Exchange 2010 SP2, what we did is we schematized rights management to the client, which means that you can now build a client that is able to get that content easily. And we also do a lot of work in the send path and so on to be able to generate that content and maintain restrictions on it. So if you're interested in that, ASRM is your new doc that's out. So there are commonalities across data types. So sync has essentially, if you look at a request, each collection or each folder has options within it. And the way you'd think of these are, let's say I want to sync 3 days of inbox, but 1 month of sent items. I want text emails versus HTML emails and all of that, right? Those options are sent by the client to the server. And if none are sent, the server just reuses the last set that were sent. So that allows the hanging sync to be really small. So MSAS Airs, which Airs was for AirSync back in the day, explains the body preferences, the body truncation settings, and the attachment enumeration. So in sync earlier, I mentioned that you get content from the server. So you can actually decide what email, what content you want, how you want your emails displayed, essentially. Are you a text client, really low-end, you don't really care for HTML? Are you an HTML client, or are you a MIME client? Each one of those, you can set the settings of how much you want of it, right? So if you think that you can build a great client and not sync the body, you can actually say full truncation, so never get me the body, and then smartly retrieve it through some other algorithm, we support that. If, you know, it's up to whatever you're building, essentially. The attachment enumeration, when you get an email, you essentially get a list of attachments. So it's just a table, and then there's another way of getting attachments. So through the sync, you'll never really receive too much content, and the client can essentially lock that down. ASCMD now explains some other common filters. The way to lock it down, as I mentioned, is through the concept of window size. So SyncE0, I mentioned earlier, you get everything. And if you don't send up a filter, you're getting everything in the given folder. So let's say you do inbox everything. To some people, that means 10,000 items. Getting a response with 10,000 items is ludicrous, right? It's ludicrous from a standpoint of server, but even more from the client, in that I don't think that you're going to be able to process the tens of megabytes or whatever that is, right? 3G doesn't help that much. 4G, okay, but not really. It's really about parsing all of that and putting it into data store and so on. So the way that can be handled is by sending a window size. Window size is a concept of how many items do you want back. So the fact that you have 1,000 new items doesn't mean you need to get them all now. You can essentially just say, I want it 50 at a time. And so the server will get 50 at a time back, which sort of limits how much you get. So as a client developer, you want to be smart. You don't want to send 2 or 3 because it means a lot of round trips. You don't want to send 10,000 because that's a huge amount of data back. Somewhere in between, we figure out like 100 is probably the right size. You know more about your buffers and your memory and allocation and so on and so forth. So window size is how that's done. Now, if there's more content with window size, the response essentially says there's more available in this folder. So the simple way to actually synchronize fully is until no more available, keep syncing that folder. Very simple. The other idea was filter settings, which I mentioned. So you can sync 1 month's worth of email in a given folder, 3 days in another, et cetera, et cetera. Or you can show that to the user, or you can just not show that to the user, and just as they keep scrolling, you can increase it smartly, so on. If you build a client, we can talk. Delete as move is a really old concept of mobile clients are probably not that smart, and so things that get deleted on the mobile client should probably be kept. Delete as move is the idea of moving essentially things that get deleted to the delete items folder. You probably want to set it to true and just forget it. And that's it. So that was it for syncing. And in terms of sending email, sync doesn't do it. So you can't add an item into an inbox. That doesn't mean anything. The server actually doesn't allow it, right? So to send an email, we have 3 commands, send mail, smart reply, and smart forward. And they all use MIME. But if you're familiar with the old version of protocol, it used to be just MIME. Now it's actually wrapped into WBXML. And there is a reason for that madness. The reason is, since it's HTTP once again, if a client does a send mail and doesn't hear back a response from the server, what does it have to do to make sure the mail got sent? Well, it has to send the mail again, which means it has to reissue that request. On the other hand, as a server, if I get a send mail, I action on it, meaning I send the email, and then I respond. If the client sends me another send mail, I have to send it because I don't know what I just sent. And so with WBXML, we now introduce a token, essentially, that says what the item is. So as a client, if it never got the response back with, yes, I've sent this mail, it uses the same token for that same mail. So as a server, I can be smart and say, no, I've already sent that one, right? So there's a few instances in the old protocols where a device would go crazy and keep sending the same email, and it's really because it wasn't getting back the response from the server. Smart reply, smart forward, the same way. Smart reply, the reason it's smart is that on the device, you don't need to actually download the entire original email, let's say. And the smartness comes from the fact that by referencing it by ID, let's say, you can essentially, you're telling the server, attach, like if it's a smart forward, you're saying attach all the attachments and add all the body of the email to it and send it out. In smart reply, we don't do attachments, we just do that. And so the person receiving the email, except for the signature that said sent from my Blackjack, so on and so forth, has no idea that you actually sent it from a mobile device. Some devices like to actually control the MIME fully, which means that they actually don't mind downloading all the content and then jiggering it and re-putting it in. For them, we actually have the concept of replace MIME. So there's a tag in the smart reply, smart forward that says, this is a reply, but I want to control all the MIME. So don't go attaching anything. Let me do everything. And so we do a few smart things, like we actually make sure that because it's part of the original conversation, we do some conversation handling, we set the flags on the original, and so on and so forth. So that's the reason to use those commands, but if you want to use the MIME, control the MIME, then you have to do that. And again, ASCMD, looking for those commands, is all defined there. And the final slide, which is, there's more to EAS than sync. So if you were to build a UI, which seems to not be in fashion anymore, and show how many items you're about to synchronize, you'd have to use, well, you could either just sync, but that's not really great. or you can do get item estimate. The idea here is you're essentially doing a sync, except there's no data transfer back. You just get the estimates of the individual folders of how much content we think you're going to get. Now, it's an estimate, so it's not actual real. So if it says 62 items, you may get 67. You may get 43, but it gives a good idea. Now, we do a lot of work to make sure the estimate is as good as it can be, but you know, don't as a developer, don't go making assumptions about buffers and so on based on those estimates. The meeting response. So meetings are challenging in that there's a lot of business logic that happens when you go accepting a meeting. So there's a part of sending the mail, the acceptance, that's fairly straightforward. The actual of how, you know, what properties need to be edited and so on and so forth was very challenging. So we have this concept of a command called meeting response. And in that, it essentially takes a referral of an item, whether it's a meeting request or email ID, or a appointment meeting ID. And then it just says, like, are you tentatively accepting, accepting, or declining? And based on what you say there, things happen in the back end. So things get deleted, things get recreated, and so on and so forth. And so that needs to be done offline if you want to offline to sync, so that then you're going to pick up the right changes from sync. And we have the concept of moving items. So in sync, it was all folder-based. Some people still like to triage mail. I'm one of them. So by triage, I mean move mails to different folders. That all goes out through move items. Because it's offline from sync, essentially, what ends up happening is in the sync process, you'll end up getting deletes. So if you're moving items from the inbox out, then the sync will just echo that back and say, you know, delete this, this, and that, and the other. In most cases, however, if you get a delete for an item you don't have as a client, developer, you ignore it. So no problems there. Then we have search. Search allows you to look for item in the mailbox, the GAL, so the global address list, and on the network. It's used essentially in combination with item operations. So item operations is the idea of going and retrieving something. So whether it's an attachment or an email that you've synchronized, whether it's an email that you've received in response to a search command, or a file on the network, that would be using item operations. Now, search has a bunch of semantics that, you know, you can search a folder, you can search the entire mailbox, you can give parameters of how, you know, the time frame you want to search, only contacts, calendars, I want to search email only, etc. So search is pretty powerful. Item operations used for fetching bodies and attachments. In item operations, if you're going to be downloading big things, you can actually chunk them, essentially, so get byte ranges of them. If you're doing a mobile device, that would be a very smart thing to do. So you can start getting things in chunks instead of trying to get a 10 megabyte attachment and failing every time, for example. Settings is a command that's used to get and set account information. Most notably, it's the out of office. So I'm out on vacation, please talk to my boss kind of deal. That's how you use it. You basically can, the device can do a get to get the current state of out of office, and then it can set it. It can say, yes, I'm out of, you know, the user types in something, it sets it up. Other things it can do is get all email addresses for a given user. So it's useful just to presentation-wise, and B, when you do smart replies, you probably don't want to include yourself. So determining who yourself is, you need to know all 1 or 10 email addresses that you have. Settings allows it to retrieve that. Settings has no state, so there is no sync key, no nothing. It's just a get and a set. Resolve recipients was originally designed to get public certificates for people who you're sending mail to. If you're doing S/MIME, you want to basically take a look at resolve recipients and validate cert. If you're not doing S/MIME, you probably can jump over these, unless you want to do meeting scheduling. If you want to do meeting scheduling, resolve recipients gives you the ability to see people's availability. So if I'm going to schedule a meeting with Joe and John, I can say Joe and John, and I can say, you know, date range, and it'll give me when they're free, when they're busy, and so on. So that was resolve recipients. I didn't include ping here, but I described it earlier. That was pretty much what I had for EAS. going through the entire protocol probably takes 2-3 days. So not to be done here. If there's any questions, now's the time. If you want to chat with me afterwards, I can stick around. And that's pretty much all I had.